From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author Mitchell S. Jackson, whose new book is Survival Math, published by Scribner. Mitchell S. Jackson's debut novel, The Residue Years, received wide critical praise. He is the winner of a Whiting Award. His novel also won the Ernest J. Gaines Prize for Literary Excellence and was a finalist for the Center for Fiction Flaherty Dunnan First Novel Prize, the Penn Hemingway Award for Debut Fiction, and the Hurston Wright Legacy Award. Jackson's honors include fellowships from the Lannan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, Penn America, TED, the New York Foundation for the Arts, and the Center for Fiction. His writing has appeared or is forthcoming in The New Yorker, Harper's, The New York Times Book Review, The Paris Review, The Guardian, Tin House, and elsewhere. He's a clinical associate professor of writing in liberal studies at New York University. Jackson is also a well-regarded speaker who has delivered lectures and keynote addresses at events including the annual TED Conference, the Ubud Bali Writers and Readers Festival, and the Sydney Writers Festival, as well as Yale, Brown, Cornell, and Columbia universities. A formerly incarcerated person, Jackson is also a social and criminal justice advocate who, as part of his efforts, visits prisons and youth facilities in the United States and abroad. His dynamic new nonfiction book, Survival Math, explores gangs and guns, near-death experiences, sex work, masculinity, composite fathers, the concept of hustle, and the destructive power of addiction, all framed within the story of Jackson, his family, and his community. Lauded for its breathtaking pace, its tender portrayals, its stark candor, and its luminous style, Survival Math reveals on every page the searching intellect and originality of its author. The primary narrative, focused on understanding the antecedents of Jackson's family's experience, is complemented by poems composed from historical American documents as well as survivor files, which feature photographs and riveting short narratives of several of Jackson's male relatives. Survival Math reflects on the exigencies over generations that have shaped the lives of so many disenfranchised Americans. Because of the originality of the book's structure and the many types of prose it is comprised of, when I spoke with him last week, I asked Mitchell S. Jackson how long he worked on Survival Math and if he knew from the start what form it would take. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I worked on the book for 7 years. And I knew going in that I wanted to write essays because I had taken it as a, in part because I had taken the reception of the residue years as a challenge to kind of work through in book form some of the ideas that I was concerned with connected to my experience and my family's experience.
Right.
Maybe middle of drafting the book, I came up with the idea for the survival files. I knew that I wanted to include some images, and then once I had the essay Survival Math, the original one, then I was like, oh, how can I explore that with my family? So that's how I came up with the narratives, and I can't remember what I was reading. It might have been Citizen, and the use of the second person, and I thought, oh yeah, there's right. My POV.
Yeah.
And then very, very late in the drafting of it, like close to handing it in, I came up with the idea for the Centos.
Yes.
And I guess all along I was thinking about using, at first they were footnotes, and then they ended up endnotes, and then they went from regular endnotes to blind endnotes. And that was maybe the last revision, because I actually did that after it was already in manuscript form, like a bound manuscript.
Oh, wow. Okay. Now, I want to talk about all those things that you just mentioned. I want to start as far as the structure of the book. You begin with a letter to an historical figure who died in Oregon, which is your state of birth. And he died on your birthday, yes. But in 1788. And you write to him in a kind of like a rumination about the circumstances of his journey to America, which he had just completed when he died. And you talk about the place you share as Black men in different times. And I thought that was such an interesting way. It just drew me right into the book, and I wanted to know about him, and I wanted to know about you. So how did you learn about Marcus, and how did you decide to begin in this way?
Well, first, I didn't know about him growing up, which is a fault of someone who should have been smarter than me. So I found out about him, I guess, actually while I was drafted, maybe midway through drafting, and I just thought, wow, how symbolic it was that the first Black life or African died in this place. And it seemed to kind of herald the fraught relationship between people of color and whites in Oregon.
Yeah.
And so I also knew that I wanted to write my daughter a letter.
Yes.
Because I wanted to give her something. I thought the book was really, it seemed male-centered at that time. And,
yeah.
And also she's turning 18 this year. So I felt like the timing was right to kind of give her something after she graduated. And because I had was determined to write her a letter, I thought, well, to me, I like beginnings and endings that echo each other or are recursive. And so that really gave me the idea to write Marcus a letter as well.
Yeah, yeah. Do they teach his life now, do you know, in the school system?
I have no idea whether or not they teach it. I know there's been several online articles about it, and there's several documentaries on, well, not several, but there's a few documentaries on Oregon Public Broadcasting, so the NPR, local NPR there.
Right.
And I know that there's a scholar at Portland State that was familiar with him, but there's really not much to teach about him because there's not much they know about his life before he boarded the ship.
Yeah. Okay. Now the language of your narrative transforms, you know, from section to section, depending on sort of the time of your own life, the places and the people that you're writing about, and also the information that you're imparting. And sometimes it's very informal. Do you mind if I read from the book?
Sure.
So we posted on hot blocks all night for damn near nothing, only half of which, if we were lucky, was ours to keep. That was our cosmos, the reason there's been a hell of a chance of finding who we've been looking for in the Justice Center, if for months we ain't seen them on the streets. So that's fairly informal. And then sometimes it's much more formal and intellectual, such as, per another story, Mama Edie moved out to Portland with the express intent of helping to integrate the Portland Public Schools, a district that announced soon after the Brown v. Board of Education ruling that it would take no action regarding segregation, despite Blacks being relegated almost exclusively to the underfunded and subpar schools in the Albina district. And then, you know, it's also sometimes very poetic. So you write, the night before my mother pushed me bawling into the universe, my Uncle George, fresh off an army discharge, blew into town and surprised her. And actually that same refrain comes back later. But can you just talk about finding the language for this book and how it felt to change the tone from section to section in this way?
The language is to me maybe most important.
Yeah.
Because I'm always trying to figure out a way, like, what's the best language, cadence, syntax that's going to reflect my personality or really my identity, like who I think I am.
Yeah.
And even in the sections where there's like heavy, like quoting or I'm working through some kind of intellectual passage, I always try to turn it so that it's not like strictly kind of an academic voice.
Right.
And a part of that is I want to always keep it in my voice, but a part of it is like I want people to know that this middle-aged now Black man with these certain kind of experiences is actually telling you this.
Right.
So it's like if I use the academic voice, I'm basically removing myself from whatever it is that I'm positing. And I actually want to insert myself as much as I can in whatever I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. I loved how the language changed, and I loved how it confounds any expectation that anybody might have, because it does change any time, you know? And it keeps you reading closely and thinking.
Yeah, there's a... I used to study with this guy named Tom Spanbauer, and he had this idea that every once in a while you should do what's called burn the syntax for the reader, so where it's where you kind of change the regular syntax so that the reader can't read over it, can't gloss it, and they have to kind of go back and read it. And so every once in a while I'll twist it. I mean, if I do it too much, then it's just all mangled. But hopefully every once in a while there'll be a sentence that you have to go back and say, like, wow, why did he cast it that way?
Yeah.
What was he trying to say there?
Yeah, but that's wonderful. I mean, that's why readers read, right? Because we love going back and looking at it again. Let's see. I love the way you consider all the men who were influences in your early life. Well, not all the men, but certain men as a group of father figures, and you collectively refer to them as pops. That was great. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about this group or these individuals as you prefer to talk about them.
Yeah. So I heard a lot growing up and even when I was an adult about the detriments of a single parent household. And I, for the most part, grew up in a single parent household, though my mother had long-term partners, but they often weren't living with us in the house. And when I got older, I was really trying to figure out what I did to kind of ameliorate those kind of troubles, but then also like what I could offer someone else who was in a similar situation. And then I thought about the men in my life who I admired growing up and the qualities that I recognized them and realized that I had kind of built a composite father figure. And so I figured, you know, there's so many men that I know, young men, boys, who are growing up in similar circumstances, that if I could, you know, offer that as an idea that you can kind of find what you think is admirable or worth modeling in men and kind of build the, it's like almost like Transformers, like you build the kind of figure that you need. You know, there's a lot of, I don't think, you know, anyone's going to do it perfectly. You know, you don't necessarily recognize all that you need, but I do think that it's not often. I can't think of anyone who I knew growing up who didn't have a few people that were trying to instill something positive in them. And so it really becomes, you know, can you recognize that? And then what are you going to do with that model or that wisdom?
Yeah. And actually, that was also really similar to a tone that you set throughout the book of just incredible, just like this graceful lens through which you look at your family history. And some of it was not very pleasant. And sometimes your family members let you down. And yet you are always defending, especially your mother, and just saying, you know, please don't assume you understand my story. And she's wonderful, you know, and that was wonderful. I wondered, do you want to talk a little bit about that? Just sort of how you framed that?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that I really take as a challenge is like writing about people who other people would either dismiss or condemn or impugn with some really harsh judgment. And I guess it just so happens that some of those people, many of those people are family members.
Yeah.
And I just think that the position that I'm always taking in my work is one of compassion. I used to have a mentor who said, never put yourself above the other in your work. And so you can offer a criticism of any other person. You also have to be able to turn that same kind of critique on yourself. And so I know that I've had, you know, plenty of things that people could critique about myself. So I try to be critical of them, but also like compassionate, like we're human beings. No one's going to be perfect. And then I'm also kind of always trying to head off the readers, what I think might be like a unfair judgment of the reader. So sometimes I'll just come out and say like, don't think that way here. Or I'll say like, I don't want any pity. I was reading a Toni Morrison interview, and she said, I write characters that are unavailable to pity.
Uh-huh.
And I think that that's like the ultimate goal of mine is to portray us. But we, you know, these hardships are, I don't want to think that I'm teaching someone for pity.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to get back to some of what you just mentioned, but I want to talk a little bit first about the just sort of the prose in the book again, or not the prose, but what's happening. There's a lot going on in the book. You move between personal stories and then many topics that sort of educate aspects of what's to come or just give us a way of stepping into them. So you have sections that begin, some of your sentences are, the origin of all the apples on Earth can be traced to the genus Malus trees that grew over 10 million years ago in Central Asia in what's now Kazakhstan. Mm-hmm. And then in another section, you start, in the ethics of ambiguity, the brilliant Simone de Beauvoir claims misfortune befalls man because he was once a child. And then in another mm-hmm. section, you write, blood banks didn't exist in the early parts of the last century. So there's just always this really interesting background that is going on before you, sort of re-enter your own story and give us a new way of thinking about it. Also, I don't speak French, so if I just mangled that name, I'm so sorry. So you include political, regional, world history, religion, language studies. I'm going to ask about the survivor files and victims reports later, apart from those, to what do you attribute the mix of subjects that contribute to the whole of this piece?
I think it really, all of the essays also begin with some kind of vignette or anecdote or scene. And I went into them with some kind of, some idea, even if it wasn't fully formed. And then once I got into them, I would say, okay, what do I need to actually kind of prove my hypothesis? And then that's where it would take me to places that I actually didn't think that I was going to be studying apple trees, ancient apple trees, or reflecting on Alcibiades' life. But, you know, I would just get in there and I would say, oh, I don't know this. And then, you know, one thing would lead me to another. And I would say, well, if one kind of text mentioned this text, well, now I have to go read this text because they're connected. And so sometimes it felt like a rabbit hole, but it was really at the basis, just me trying to contextualize the present moment. And, you know, you don't know how far back you have to. I mean, if we're talking about patriarchy, like how far do we have to go back to understand? Like, do we got to go back, if you're religious, to Adam and Eve? Like, right. I don't know. But you just don't know what it will take to kind of get to why are my friends killing each other?
Yeah.
You know, where do we start that as a exploration?
Right. And it's so much more subtle and interesting to go back to apples than to go directly to Adam. I mean, it was just, you know, we spend time reading it going like, why is he talking about apples? And then it starts to make sense.
I hope in the end it makes sense.
It does, definitely. Okay, the book has four sections. Who are we? What have we learned? What have we endured? And how do we proceed? Mm-hmm. So when did the structure come into the writing of the book? And was that like a great moment where you decided these will be the four sections?
It was really early. I remember sitting down with my editor and just kind of talking about structure. I think I might have had maybe three essays drafted at that time. And we were kind of asking ourselves questions back and forth. And then we were like, oh, like, what if we arranged it around these questions? I was like, oh, yeah, that's it. And then it was kind of thinking about the essays that would actually answer those questions. So I had the questions before I had the essays, really. And then very, very late, when I was in manuscript is when I had came up with the idea to write Centos.
Right.
But I didn't want to have the questions as separate and then the Centos. So that's when I decided to make them titular lines, where I just say, okay, the question is going to be the first line of every poem.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I wanted to talk about the poems, the Centos. Do you have a copy of the book handy?
Yeah, hold on.
I was wondering if you wouldn't mind reading What Have We Learned?
Yeah, okay. What have we learned? In the course of human events, the world will little note nor long remember our numberless afflictions. No refuge could save us from the terror of flight or gloom of the grave. The men who framed the Declaration were principled, free. People of the United States and citizens are synonymous, but we, were not included under the word citizens. And no nation so conceived can long endure. Known facts. We had no rights the white man was bound to respect.
Great. Thank you. Can you talk about the poems a little bit, maybe as a whole, and about composing them? But also, I wanted to talk about the bracketed words in that poem, which listeners can't see, but the words our and we are bracketed, which I thought was really interesting in the context of the meaning of that particular poem. So maybe we can start there.
So the poems are composed from historic American documents. I woke up one night and I had my subtitle, Notes on an All-American Family, and I was really determined to fight someone's or a reader's kind of tendency to kind of marginalize these stories. Mm-hmm. And I really, really wanted to like situate them in the American history. And so I was like, oh, I know what to do. I had found out about this form, the Centos, which is a poem made from the lines of other poems. I said, oh, I'll use historic American documents. And in that way, you know, people will recognize maybe some of these lines, but also it's like I'm taking these kind of venerated texts and then showing how they were used to kind of oppress, not even kind of, to oppress people that look like me over the course of history. So I have Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death, Notes on the State of Virginia, Gettysburg Address, Dred Scott, Plessy versus Ferguson, the Federalist Papers, Declaration of Independence, all of these. There's 10 texts in total. But then also there were moments in the text where it didn't quite articulate the we and the our. And I was really interested in kind of defining what they meant by we and our, you know, like when you read the Declaration of Independence and they're saying we, yeah, they mean we white men, you know, they didn't really mean the rest of it. So this is also me kind of, again, kind of violating this authority that has worked as hegemonic over people that look like me.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, it really sort of made me stop and think about what the word referred to, you know. And it's, again, like what you were saying before, it sort of, you know, makes you stop and makes you think. And okay, thank you. And thanks for reading that. Okay, so the cover of the book is a montage, or it's actually like, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's 16 photographs, face shots, mm-hmm. Of men who are in your family. And then their stories are the survivor files that we've talked about. They are all written in the second person, and they're based on your, I guess, interviews with these people in your family. So I wondered if you can talk about organizing these stories, and whose words did you use when you wrote them? I mean, are they mostly the words of the people in each photo, or are you editing them heavily? Or I was curious about that, too.
Yes. So, I asked each of the men the same question. And that was, what's the toughest thing that you've survived?
Right.
And so they are their words. They're their stories as they told them. I mean, they didn't tell them to me in second person. That was a aesthetic choice, or I guess a rhetorical choice. But I didn't. These are the stories exactly as they told them. Mm. There are there's moments in each one of the files where I look towards the future and look towards the past. And that happened because the first file that I wrote, which is actually the first file in the book, was someone who I was there for the most. I mean, I knew them maybe, I'm not the best, but I knew enough about them to know how to situate their story. Because I had done that with his story, I was like, oh, I've set a precedent now. I have to do it for the rest of the story. So I actually had to go back in some cases and ask them about things that kind of presaged the current conflict, and then kind of for them to reflect on what happened afterwards.
Right.
The second person, I think, works as like a really dynamic POV, and that it works like a first person, but then it also invites the reader to imagine themselves as a protagonist. And I thought, oh, these stories are going to be, kind of disparate from the experience of I guess the reader that I imagine, I'm like, well, how can I close that empathy gap between them?
Right. Yeah, that was absolutely perfect, because I think the first person would have made it really easy to think, well, this is just some well, actually, the third person would probably be the most distancing, where it's like, this is just somebody yeah. else. It's not anybody to do with me. The I mm-hmm. also isn't any specific involvement of the reader, but the you is very compelling that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought. Are there men in your family that weren't included that are really now very offended?
I don't think there are men that are offended. I hope not, at least.
I'm just kidding. How did you pick these?
I mean, I got a lot. I mean, I think, I don't know, because I haven't talked to many people in my family who weren't. I don't see them much. Like, the people that I really keep in contact with
right.
are all on the cover. So, yeah, that'd be interesting, though. I wonder how the other people feel. Like, I remember there was a billboard of the cover in Times Square, and my, like, grandfather was excited about it, and my brothers were excited about it. So I wonder now if, like, my cousin saw it and was like, man, why didn't he ask me?
And then I thought it must have been cool when they, I don't know, maybe it was you who came up with the cover, but did you envision the cover this way when you wrote the book?
I did envision using the images on the cover. I didn't know if they were going to use a Polaroid, but they were actual Polaroids, so I was happy that they did. And we actually made very few alterations to the kind of first draft of the cover. The only thing we did, they were, aligned. So then we had, like, there's, you know, the kind of crooked line near the spine is really about, and then the subtitle was in a different text, but that was the only two kind of alterations we made from what they initially sent me, which is interesting because on the residue years, I had 17 different cover attempts.
Wow.
Before they forced me to go back and accept like an initial cover.
Yeah. Well, this is great. And you took these pictures, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I took the pictures. Yeah. I was really like, I was going to use a photographer, but then I was like, it's going to kind of thwart this intimacy that I want to create. So I thought that I would get the best, you know, the most honest photo from being in space with them alone. And so that's what I try to create, those circumstances for each one of them.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see, how has your family reacted to being included and examined in the book? And I'll just remind listeners that, you know, some of the ways that they're included are not always that flattering because of the circumstances of the stories. Although, as I mentioned, you're always very sympathetic to them.
Yeah, there's been, you know, some people that have emailed me and said, you know, why is such and such portrayed, or, you know, people that think they can be identified in survival files, someone was upset. But, you know, I tell them, you know, I didn't intend this to hurt anyone. I held myself up to just as harsh a line, I think, as I did anyone else in it. And also, I'm always trying to kind of look at all sides of it. So I don't portray anyone as all bad, but I also don't portray anyone as all good.
Right.
And I think, you know, the people would have to know me. Like, these people that I'm writing about, like, I have relationships with that extend before and beyond writing. And so I hope that they know that I'm not trying to, like, tear anyone down or, you know, ruin anyone's reputation. I'm really trying to create, you know, an honest ledger of us living and breathing in Portland.
Right. Well, and it's very real. You know, I mean, it's an all, and the fact that it's an all-American story is just like, what a wonderful way to refer to it, because, you know, that as a kind of, I don't know, trope is always sort of held up with apple pie, and, you know, and it's
right.
like, some of these stories are very gritty and very difficult. You know, yeah. I mean, I remember the first, I think you were talking about the first survivor file. I think that one was about the shooting, right?
Yeah. Almost shooting. Yeah.
Yeah. Almost shooting. So yeah, I mean, anyway, I thought it was very effective, and I thought you were very sympathetic to your family's situation. So you just mentioned victim statements, and that is another part of the book I wanted to talk about. You begin by explaining victimology, as the study and analysis of victims. And you have other sections where you explain different aspects of that study. And then you share statements from some of your exes, women with whom you've had relationships. So I wanted to talk about the decision to include those.
Well, that essay is called The Scale, and it's really a reflection or critique on womanizing, and which is not is misogyny and not disconnected from patriarchy. And it was born of me reading an essay back in 2011 called Why Men Cheat, written by an anonymous author who was talking about why he cheated on his wife and what his rules were for cheating. And I recognized some of my previous pathologies in some of his articulations, but then I also had very strong critique about what he did. And the main critique was that he never reflected on the fallout of his deeds.
Yeah.
And then I was also really critical that he did it anonymously. And so I challenged myself to do that same kind of reflecting. There's a really early draft of the essay, but it didn't include like me trying to historicize womanizing. But when I went back to the essay, which was the last one that I revised for the book, because I had already situated every other idea in history, I knew that I had to do the same thing for that essay. So that's when I started to look at, okay, well, where does misogyny come from? Where does patriarchy come from? And who were these kind of historical womanizers? And, you know, I ended up back at, you know, Alcibiades and,
yeah,
you know, Lord Byron. And not to deflect, but really to understand where these ideas came from. But the victim statements was because that essay is structured as a criminal profile, and one part of a criminal profile is victimology, where you really do like a exhaustive kind of detailing of the victim, their circumstances, their history. And while I was writing that, I was also very concerned that even though I was trying to be critical and empathetic, that it was still all in my voice. And very late in drafting it, I said, well, I guess the only reasonable thing to do, or gracious thing I guess I can do, is to allow them the chance to speak. And not all of them wanted to, but a couple of them did. And I told them, you know, whatever you tell me, I'm going to put down. I'm not going to change it.
Right.
So I'm giving them a voice, but I'm really giving women a voice in the piece.
Yeah. It felt very balanced that you did that. It felt appropriately balanced. Because you were sort of owning your own role in the patriarchy. I wanted to talk a little bit that, you know, it sounds like this is such a serious book, but there is humor in the book too. I didn't actually mark the page, so I can't read it, but there's just this section where you're writing about your father and your uncle, I guess, robbed a bank. And they end up going to prison, but it sounds like it was a pretty decent experience for your father anyway,
yeah,
going to prison. But there's a lot of humor in that whole section. It was very funny. So did that just happen, or were you trying to be funny to kind of lighten things up, or did that just sort of happen as you wrote?
Well, I have arguments every family dinner about who's the funniest Jackson. I have staked the claim. I have defended what I think is the crown. But I really do. Like, my dad was, and he was going through stuff that I actually didn't know that he was going through, but was always funny. And I've kind of taken that as like, you know, people expect you to be, hanging your head all the time. But like, we have to find humor in these circumstances. Otherwise, it just overcomes you. And so it really wasn't me reaching for funny. It's really how I kind of see the world. Like, I've been in some really tight, I mean, I've told lots of jokes when I was in prison, you know? So, I think, this is a necessity as far as I see. And it really is the paradigm through which I see the world. Like, I'm always seeing humor or making a joke or trying to lighten someone's mood. And it just seemed fitting to write about him like that because he may have been the funniest person that I've known in my life.
That's really appropriate then that his section or that section included him.
Yeah.
But there are other parts that are very funny too. Let's see. Well, you just mentioned having been in prison. I guess I haven't actually even addressed that, which is a part of the book, but you went to prison for selling drugs. And did that affect your decision to become a writer? Do you want to talk about that a little bit, maybe?
Yeah. Well, I think it's one thing to know is, like, I actually never write about being in prison.
Yeah.
And it happens during the kind of timeline of this novel. Because I think, you know, for me, it's the interesting thing is not that I was in prison. It's how I got to prison and what I did once I came home.
Right.
But yeah, it was absolutely instrumental in me wanting to become a writer. I started writing the residue years, what became the residue years, on loose leaf paper while I was in prison, because I was a college junior when I went.
Uh-huh.
I knew I was going back because I was on scholarship. And I really started writing the book because, A, I thought, like, oh, I'll tell my life story. But I'll fictionalize it because I don't want to get anyone in trouble. But also, this is a way of me preparing myself to go back to college. And so I had like 50 loose leaf pages when I came home, and I ended up, you know, typing those out and working and going to 2 graduate programs. And 12 years later, they were published as the residue years.
Yeah.
So had I not gone to prison, probably would have never been a writer.
Wow. Yeah. That doesn't surprise me, but it's interesting to hear that story. Let's see. The notes at the back of the book are wonderful. You know, I think I usually expect notes to be kind of dry and and they just kind of expand on something in the prose, pretty dry and intellectual. But your notes weren't like that. And I'm really glad I went through and read through them because they're entertaining and enlightening. I wondered how you decided what went into the actual book and what became a note.
Well, I'll tell you one instance. There's a note in Apples that's 20 pages long.
Yeah.
And at some point, the end notes were actually footnotes. And I fought with my editor, like, Mitch, this is going to disrupt the text, and no one wants to read all this information, and you're going to distract them. And so imagine that at some point in Apples, there was, you know, a few paragraphs, and then a long 26-page footnote in the middle of Apples.
That would have been pretty funny.
And I was, like, determined to keep it. And she was like, Mitch, you just can't. So my compromise was to have end notes. And then later, I came up with, well, actually, it was my editor-in-chief, Nan Graham, who suggested I use blind notes, which I hadn't even heard of. So she suggested a few books, gave me the books, and then I was like, oh, yeah, this is a good idea.
Yeah.
But the end notes, have you ever read Junot Diaz, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde?
Yeah.
Yeah, so his end notes were really, instructional for me, because his end notes are like him talking, like the characters talking, and they're funny. And they're really, like, almost challenging the construct of endnotes, or the efficacy of endnotes. And I wanted that voice.
Yeah.
Like, I wanted to be able to tell another story or to not have them be so dry. So again, it's really me kind of challenging convention in the endnotes. I'm like, who made these rules? Who are the rules for? Why can't I violate them? What does it say if I am violating them? And so that the endnotes was another way to me to kind of assert myself.
Yeah. Yeah, they were great. And I had forgotten that about Junot Diaz's book. That's good to remember. Okay, I am not saying that I ever felt this way, but I sometimes wonder if in writing memoir, and this is ultimately a memoir, if authors grow weary of their stories. Did this ever happen to you while you were working on it?
It didn't happen to me in this case, because so much of this is about another person.
Right.
So it was more revelatory for me. I do think if I focus this more on myself, that it's possible. But I'll tell you that I don't intend to kind of explore my family history in the same sustained way in a future project.
Right.
So I'm kind of, I do want to talk about home. I'm very invested in writing only about home, but, like, I did it in the residue years in fiction. I've done it now, more expansive in survival math. And so I think that I've covered it. Like, I want a different kind of challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I wanted to ask you if you've read anything lately that you might recommend to listeners, most of whom are, you know, readers. So
Toni Morrison's The Source of Self-Regard is what I'm reading now. And it's so astounding, like the breadth of her understanding, her knowledge of history, her kind of wisdom, her the way that she recognizes systems and can like compare different eras of history. Like, I'm only on page about 70, but I have copious notes. I'm always underlining things. And the thing that maybe most impresses me is, like, there are a lot of smart people in the world, but they're not necessarily wise. And I was reading this essay a few weeks ago about, it was called Wisdom in the Age of the Internet. And the person, Maria Popova is her name, but she had defined information, knowledge, and wisdom. She said information was some basic fact about the world. Knowledge was like figuring out how facts go together to reveal some truth about the world. And then that wisdom had a moral component to it. So she said it was like having the knowledge, but then also using that knowledge to assess how the world should work.
Yeah.
So it was like seeing the best version of the world. And to me, Toni Morrison is wise, right? Like, she has the knowledge, but then she also is seeing like the best version of whatever that phenomenon is that she's writing about. And then obviously the language is so beautiful too. So it's like daunting to me. It's like, wow, could anyone ever do this again? I don't know. But it's beautiful.
Okay, wonderful. What are you working on now in your own work? What are you writing next?
I'm on a fellowship with the Pen America, and the fellowship is a criminal justice initiative. And so I'm actually doing survivor files for women. I've got the material for three of them. So the subjects are women who either work in criminal justice or were formerly criminally justice involved. And I'm doing the same thing. I'm asking them, you know, the question of what they survived. I took their photos. And again, I want people to kind of read the stories and then say, oh, is this person formerly criminally justice involved, or are they a probation officer? So that's what I'm working on now. But my next long project, I'm on a fellowship next year. I'm working on a novel about a cult leader.
Oh, wow. Cool. Yeah. I'm curious, with the women's survivor files, do you find that there are women who would rather not share that with a man?
Luckily these women, I had, again, people that I knew. Well, at least two of them I already knew. So
okay,
they were not resistant to sharing. And I was actually astounded by what they shared with me.
Yeah, I would imagine. I know that you teach, you lead workshops in prisons.
Yeah, I teach at NYU.
So you teach at NYU, and you also lead workshops for incarcerated youth and adults. So
yeah.
So is that tied in with the survivor files for women, or is that separate?
No, that's well, I mean, yeah, in theoretically they're all of the same thing. They're still kind of part of me wanting to connect with people who have similar experiences, but they're not directly connected.
Okay. All right. Great. So your next project, when you get to your fellowship year, is going to be a novel. So do you have a preference of fiction versus nonfiction, or do you feel like they're just different parts of you?
Well, I'll tell you now, I have conceived of two more projects, and they're both fiction. One is a collection of short stories, and one is the novel. And I cannot imagine now what would interest me enough to write another nonfiction book.
Okay.
I mean, maybe, you know, who knows, 10 years from now, I'll go back to it. But I can't see it in the trajectory right now.
Okay. All right. My last question is always advice for writers. And I wanted to read one more of your sentences, or I think it's maybe a paragraph, and then we could talk about some advice. You write, "In addition to being my mother's son, at present I'm a father, a brother, a grandson, a nephew, an uncle, a friend, a writer, a professor, a speaker, a dreaming and dreaming dreamer, and for a great many of my 43 years on earth, a terrible, awful, despicable caretaker of women's hearts." I loved this sentence, partly because it reminded me of Alexander and the terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. Do you know that book? That's like a children's book. But anyway, when we've already talked about how you take yourself to task in the book for your role in hurting others, but I just want to finish by asking you for advice for listeners who are writers and want to present full depictions of themselves or some aspect of themselves in their work, and just your advice about owning their misdeeds as well as their good deeds. If that's even something that you would advise. I'm putting words in your mouth, but...
No, I mean, I think you got to figure out if you're ready for it. Because I think, you know, some people are just not ready to kind of criticize themselves in a way that I think is necessary if you're going to write, you know, memoir or essay or autobiography. But I have a friend who was in, he was actually in prison with me. And he was like he wasn't the best storyteller, but he would often have these stories. And I would say, "Man, are you serious? Did that really?" And he used to say, "Man, listen, I ain't going to put nothing on it and I ain't going to take nothing off it."
I love that.
And I used to, you know, back then I used to be like, "Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. I hear you." But later, you know, since I've been teaching, I'm like, "Wow, what sage writing advice," right? So it's like, can you see the thing for the thing itself? And that doesn't mean that you don't critique it or that you don't see value in it. It means that you don't exaggerate. And so I think maybe that's the kind of the best way for a writer to view their own experience or any other experiences. Like, you've got to be able to see it for what it is. And that also means you have to be able to see it in context.
Yeah.
Right. So like the most evil guys that I know, I have to see them, or what I thought, who I thought were evil. Like, no one was born evil. Right. So like, well, what is the context that brought them to these circumstances?
Right. I love that. Well, I want to just mention again, the name of the book is Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family by Mitchell S. Jackson, published by Simon & Schuster. Mitchell, thank you so much for speaking with me. I really enjoyed it, and it's a fabulous book.
Yeah, I did too. This is one of my favorite interviews.
Oh, yay!
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author, Mitchell S. Jackson. His book is Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family, published by Scribner. You can learn more about Mitchell S. Jackson's work at his website, mitchellsjackson.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Mitchell S. Jackson. Write your own answer to the question, "What is the hardest thing that you have survived?" Write it in the second person. Mitchell says you may find that this encourages a new and different version of the story than that which you might have narrated yourself in the first person. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're listening, then you know that this is our new time slot, a single hour from 4 to 5 p.m. every Monday. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.